So this is the Granley Bakken Resort. As you know, this is a Keystone Symposia meeting on Newitt's insights into health span and diseases of aging, from molecular to functional senescence. And that title, New Insights from into Health Span and Diseases of Aging, fits very well with your talk. We are with Monica Driscoll, who's from Rutgers University, and her talk is going to be Genetic and Pharmacological Extension of Health Span in a Simple Animal Model. So what's the simple animal? A worm?
Yes, the simple animal is a tiny roundworm named Caenorhabditis elegans officially. This is an absolutely fantastic model organism. You could find it in the soil, but we have strains that have been kept in lab for years. And in fact, all the people who work on this organism study animals that are descended from just one animal isolated from the soil in the late 1960s in Bristol, England. So one of the great advantages of working with this little model is that there's a very uniform genetic background. So we can compare from lab to lab and experiment to experiment. The animal has 959 cells. It's transparent. You can see through the animal to look at these cells. You can label those cells with fluorescent markers, and you can follow individual cells. And you can do genetics. You can find animals that, for example, live longer or live better than wild-type animals. So it's been a very powerful model. There's probably, you know, more than 2,000 people, scientists in the world who work on this model to study all kinds of issues of development, of basic regulatory biology, and aging.
So you're talking about the community of worm runners.
Yes.
Which is a nice community. We were at a poster session last night, and I was watching you. You were talking to one of the poster presenters about the swimming behavior.
Yes.
Of this little creature. And everybody got very animated, and there was all this great conversation about how it swims and how you could possibly get it to swim in a straight line and all those sorts of things. I suppose this all goes back originally, just on a small historical note here, to my colleague Sidney Brenner, who made this the animal of choice.
Yes, yes. So Sidney was, you know, absolutely the father of this field. And as I understand it, he had gotten bored of cracking the genetic code and figuring out, you know, various other things. He was very, very interested in developing a model where you could figure out how genes and cells influenced behavior. And he thought that was going to be kind of the next big thing, our molecular, ultimately molecular understanding of behavior. And so, as I understand it, kind of searched through some of the old German embryological studies where they described some of the features of the animal. It self-fertilizes, so you can put one animal on a plate and it will actually make 300 genetically identical copies of itself without any real perturbation. And so that's a nice feature. It almost was like an expanded bacterium in a way. You feed it, it makes more of itself. And he pioneered the genetic analysis and, of course, won a Nobel Prize for founding this field. But the field actually, a few really fantastic postdoctoral workers went to work with him at the MRC. And that was kind of the first generation of C. elegans researchers. And the community, I think, had to stay together to survive. There are so many interesting components of just the development. Just to look at this animal, it's incredibly beautiful. You need a microscope to kind of appreciate it. But it's a millimeter big when it's grown up. And but under the microscope, you know, you can actually watch the sequence of cell divisions that occur as you go from the fertilized egg to the 959-celled animals. Everyone has been tracked by John Sulston and his colleagues. Got the Nobel Prize for, shared the Nobel Prize for their work. So it's just, The animal is fantastic. The community was very tightly bound and was small. Even so, I'm considered the third generation. My mentor is Marty Chalfie, who worked at the, who also has a Nobel Prize for some work associated with green fluorescent protein, but taking full advantage of the features of C. elegans to really develop this to revolutionize cell biology.
Yeah, I was actually talking with Marty about a week ago because he was at the Salk Institute, and he's a great proponent of science communication, I must tell you. So, as you know, so how difficult is it to make the leap from this speck of dust size organism and to use what we know of it? Because you're talking about possible extension of health span in a simple animal model, to leap from speck of dust size to us sitting in chairs here.
Right. So you would think that it's a huge, colossal, amazing leap. But we've seen again and again and again that's not the case, that you can dissect the fundamental mechanisms of how all kinds of things work, developmental processes, behavioral signaling, neuronal signaling, and you can take the advantages of a very simple uniform genetic model that you can put genes in and out, put color their cells, etc., and figure out the basic biology. And almost always, it's the case that that same process occurs in higher organisms like us with more bells and whistles. And I could give you one example that I'll talk about later in my talk. Has to do with health span and a drug that that's currently in use in the clinic as an anti-diabetic drug. And so it's been possible, so it's been suspected that that drug improves human health span. It certainly helps diabetic patients. And it's been shown moderately convincingly that it acts as what's called a dietary restriction mimetic, which is kind of, it induces a healthy sort of metabolism. And we tried it on C. elegans. It works via a dietary restriction mechanism. All the enzymes that are known to be used for its efficacy in higher organisms are needed in C. elegans. But in addition, we're able to use the C. elegans model to discover a new gene that's really critically important for the function that the mammalian people didn't suspect. Mm-hmm. And now, although this is very preliminary, there's a strong suggestion that yes, when you go back to the mammal and look whether this part of this component of the signaling is the same, then it is. So there are many examples where we need the tools. You know, basically, what you want to do is figure out how something works, and then you can ask if the same thing happens in a higher organism. We can get C. elegans to cure its degenerative disease. We can get C. elegans to swim like an Olympic athlete later in life and not suffer from muscle decline, for example. And then when we learn those rules, then we say, then we know how to ask in a very directed way, in a higher organism, does this work? Can it work? And so often it does. It's astonishing because it is a little fleck of dust with 959 cells, and we're incredibly more complex than that. But the basic rules apply, even for aging biology.
So I gather from some of the other just talking to Ana Maria Cuervo, you have a habit of introducing your talks with a clip from Indiana Jones, I think, right?
Oh, I think, I have used that. My computer got stolen and I lost it. But yes, there is a clip in the movie Indiana Jones and the Holy Grail. And, you know, he goes through all these escapades to find where the Holy Grail is. And the legend is that a knight has been guarding this, kind of an immortal knight. And he's been guarding this Holy Grail for 900 years or something. And Indiana Jones finally comes in and he sees this, you know, fairly big knight with a really big sword. And the knight goes to pick up the sword and he can't lift it. He just falls, you know, essentially just falls over. And this is classic sarcopenia. This
right.
is the age-associated decline in muscle mass and strength that it affects everyone. And is progressive, but in the modern real world, it's a major contributor to frailty and kind of functional decline, quality of life decline. And you see people slowing, you see people the loss of strength really impairs certain things. Actually, the hardest thing I understand is to get out of a chair. But opening doors, etc. And that's, now that people are living longer, this becomes a more significant problem.
And you see the same thing in worm?
The worm, so this is astonishing, but we see exactly the same thing in C. elegans. With a midlife onset, there's a progressive loss in the locomotory ability, several types of locomotory ability. And this is tightly correlated with decline in the cellular structure that almost perfectly parallels what's been described for some muscle decline in human sarcopenia. So again, it's astonishing that an animal that lives for 3 weeks can have the same sequelae of phenotypes of aging that a individual who can live for 100 years does, but they do. And that's a great thing, because in the lab, what we are trying to do is identify genetic manipulations and pharmacological manipulations that change that trajectory. So they enable the animal to behave like a young, move, swim, like a young animal, even when it's quite far out through its lifespan. So that the idea is that in the worm, we can certainly slow either muscle decline specifically or the general systemic decline associated with aging, and hope that we learn lessons from that can ultimately translate to the clinic.
So how do you do that? How do you get happy worms?
Right. So what we do is we kind of take two sorts of approaches. One is fairly straightforward, and that's a pharmacological approach. So we just feed them drugs, and we can test drugs that there have been hints may be beneficial for preserving muscle function in humans, and try to develop the story a little bit more in C. elegans. Another thing we're doing in a wonderful collaboration with the International Biodiversity Group is they collect extracts from plants from all over the world, and they use these botanicals. They can fractionate them or prepare some kind of extract, and we test them on the animal and see if it's happier. So a happier animal in midlife is moving vigorously, will swim vigorously. It has certain lower features. There are certain things that occur in C. elegans and in humans, and across the board, these things called age pigments, which are lipofuscin and advanced glycation end products, and these accumulate in aging individuals. And so we track; they're actually very easy to track in a transparent worm. They're naturally fluorescent, and so animals that have low levels generally live healthier. We test their a model of heart function, which is their pharyngeal pumping. It's actually part of their feeding mechanism, many analogies to higher organism heart. And let's see what else. And then we also track how they live, so that that we track their survival over time. And a happier worm, a worm with a better health span, will at least for the median lifespan be significantly extended. So its survival and vigor are extended if we put these drugs on. Likewise, we can do genetic manipulations where we put genes in, take genes out. There are a lot of easy tricks in this animal for doing this very quickly. And in fact, we can actually systematically knock down the activity of every single gene of the worm just by feeding it a special bacteria. So this, again, is a fantastic experimental tool. So we can take the time to screen through, and I could tell you every gene that you could knock down that will extend the health span of the muscle. So then I will know what protein this encodes, and we can think of those as targets to manipulate in a higher organism.
So these advanced glycation end products, the acronym of course is AGE, which is very appropriate. How do they typically build up? I mean, because we end up with sort of a creme brulee effect here, don't we?
Right. So these actually, the advanced glycation end products, yes, come from kind of a random cross-linking of sugars to proteins. If you have high sugar, like for example, diabetics actually have higher levels of these advanced glycation end products that you can detect in their skin, actually using the same instrument that we use for C. elegans. We started using this instrument on worms because a graduate student in my lab was dating a guy who was working for Johnson & Johnson Skillman skincare products. And, you know, he was working on aging skin. My graduate student was working on aging C. elegans. And they decided to, you know, do one of these late night experiments and figured out that was a wonderful way for measuring these things in vivo. So this is another thing. It's very appealing to be able to measure the animal in a non-invasive way. Yeah. So these accumulate with age. In general, there's not a good mechanism that cells or tissues have to get rid of these products. And so that's why you can see this progressive accumulation of them over time, and they serve as kind of a biomarker for the age of the animal.
Does this connect with the conversation I had with Ana Maria Cuervo about the removal of the garbage, autophagy,
yes,
and so on?
Yes, in fact, the lipofuscin, yes, this is definitely a common theme. So the lipofuscin is, again, just kind of a lot of cross-linked material that can't get degraded. And the cells have a garbage can called the lysosome. And so this material more or less gets transported into the lysosome. But when it's there, so the lysosome's job normally is to degrade that garbage, and it's like the trash compactor. But when that's not happening, that garbage can is full. And that lysosome can no longer process the other proteins that are coming in, organelles that are coming in to be degraded. So this gradual increase of kind of untreatable waste is something that we think ultimately, just as what would happen in your kitchen, you know, causes a very unpleasant backup. There's nowhere else to put the garbage, it doesn't come in, and then it contributes to the dysfunction of cells and the failure to kind of maintain good homeostasis.
So you end up being kind of a perpetual landfill. And
right.
So you mentioned the pharmacology here. I'm just looking back at a piece that was in the New York Times at the end of last year called the Calorie Restriction Experiment. And it was a piece about that work that's being done in the comprehensive assessment of long-term effects of reducing intake of energy, calorie, at WashU and Tufts. There's this question about whether the calorie restriction people who, you know, whether that's an efficacious thing to be doing, first of all, because I asked Paul Shaw and Mark Tater and Sean Oldham yesterday, okay, I assume that calorie restriction really works then. This is a great thing. We should all be doing it. And they all looked at me and said, well, yeah, if you're a rodent or a worm, but it's not clear that necessarily works in humans. So that's point one. And the second point was that the question is raised in this thing, why should you actually do something like calorie restriction, which is a tough regime, if you could take a pill that somehow reproduces its effects? So, two questions there.
Right. So the first question is, will this be something that works for humans? I suspect yes, but it's not an uncomplicated protocol. So one important thing about dietary restriction is that there's an optimal caloric intake. And so if you look at the curve, kind of amount of food and the lifespan benefit, you get a curve like this. If you're too far to one to the left, you're starving. Too little food, you're starving. That's a very unhealthy situation. Too far to the right is probably where a lot of us are, and that is that you know there's a deleterious effect probably of having so much food. It's probably true that we evolved under circumstances where that wasn't usually the case. And so we're a little bit off probably our optimal metabolism. But the jury's out. Experiments are being done, primate experiments, in terms of whether this will really work in humans. But a key point that I think we appreciate about caloric restriction is that it's not optimal for everything. That you're a little bit more risk if you had some situation where you had to stop eating or something, you're at risk. And so there's definitely a cost benefit kind of analysis. Now it seems to me that there are ways that we might be able to manipulate our understanding of dietary restriction to put people in that kind of optimal metabolism. And certainly humans are incredibly complex and diverse. So I'm trying to think of what your other question is, whether it's much better to take a pill.
So is this, right. Yeah, I mean, right. Plainly, so, a pharma must be in this because they see the big pharma must see baby boomer generation,
right.
Aging is a big topic, it's on the covers of all the magazines, this must be a huge marketplace.
Right,
there.
Right. And there's I think there's a pressure there. So in terms of the real biology, I think that there's a phenomenon of kind of optimal, there's an optimal metabolism that is healthy under kind of our standard living circumstances. And it's probably true. So I can only speak for worms, really. But it seems to be the case that we can administer drugs, some of them actually already in use in humans in the clinic, that can kind of put the animal into a dietary restriction-like state and extend the period of healthy living. So it seems like, you know, it's plausible. Whether we'll see, you know, this level of understanding in our lifetime, I don't know.
But I assume you can't tell what the state of these calorically restricted worms are. I mean, they're not sitting there going, humph, humph, humph. There's no... Is there any overt behavioral
sign
of whether they're happy worms or not?
What I can tell you is nice about it from the human perspective is that these animals can be eating, you know, nonstop. So they don't stop eating, and they're still feeding. So they, and despite the fact that they have a dietary restriction like metabolism and profile. So what they do is they have so why they look better to us is they have lower age pigment levels. They swim better for longer. They survive better. Their median, their average lifespan is extended, but not necessarily, for us actually, not necessarily their maximum lifespan.
Right.
For me, this is actually okay. I think, you know, it's a critically important health issue to have individuals living to their maximal health capacity.
Right.
And that's probably enough to kind of improve the quality of aging, I think, is a good goal, it's a worthy goal. And if you find an intervention that kind of does that, even though it doesn't push out the very end of the lifespan is probably still a very valuable thing to do.
Did you think when you were growing up that this was what you were going to do? I mean, what?
This per se, no. I went to a high school reunion and everyone said, oh, well, of course, you were going to be a biologist. And
really?
Yes, in fact, I don't know if you want these, you know, personal history stories, but for me, what did it was, there's a Dr. Seuss book called Horton Hears a Who. And the plot of this book is that there's a, Horton is this huge elephant, and he picks up this little, it's actually a fleck of dust, and on it, he has big ears or something, he hears a little sound, and he discovers that there's a whole world of all these little people, I guess they're called Whos, that live in this speck, and he can't see them, but if they all make a noise together, he can actually hear them. And this concept of, like, something that was, that was too small to see, and yet you could get evidence that it was there, was, it just blew me away. And I love that. I started cracking rocks open, and I mean, I just always really, like, you know, and then my parents kind of picked up on this, and, you know, I got little microscopes and chemistry sets. So I guess I always just, like, had a fascination with this, with basic biology, and it's, you know, it's a wonderful area to train in. I mean, there's nothing more beautiful than the nature and how the molecules work, development. I mean, yeah. It's incredible. So it's a great, you know, it's a great beauty to be able to enjoy.
Which part of the country did you grow up in?
I grew up in New Jersey, the Northeast.
Yeah, and you're right, Rutgers now.
Yes, so. And I ended up back there, which has worked out very well.
Right. So did you have for a woman going into science, fine, no problems, lots of encouragement, mentors, what?
That's an interesting question. I would say that when I was kind of coming through, there were opportunities that were provided by people who really struggled ahead of me. But there wasn't, I never really got a big push in particular. I was fortunate, I think, that I just really liked to do what I was doing. The people that I've worked for, I think, have been very, open-minded and, you know, fair-minded, modern-minded, and have been kind of supportive, but in a way that was never all that different from my male colleagues. I think possibly much later in life, there are certain things that I see as more challenging for a woman than a man. You know, some of the challenges of child rearing and you know, just kind of slightly unequal burden.
The reason I ask is that I'm trying to find out if there's been a shift over time in that, you know, you still have an organization called Women in Science and Technology, which one would hope would at some point become extinct. You'd hope.
Right.
But even this year, there's a book come out called The Elephant in the Laboratory, which deals with the whole issue of how difficult this can be for a woman to progress as rapidly in science as she might want.
Right, right. And certainly the numbers kind of bear this out. There are fewer women that are at the professor level than there are in the postdoc and graduate student level. And
but some nice Nobel Prizes this year for women. So
yes,
that's
we're very proud of that.
That's a good thing to see.
Right.
Do you take Monica and the microscope and the worm, and do you take that information and relay it to a general audience? I mean, are you asked to give advice to people about how they should do, what their diet should be like?
We talk about it.
Translation.
Yes. So there are kind of more formal translation things that we do, not necessarily in terms of advice, but I'll go to, you know, the grammar school and tell them about C. elegans, show kids C. elegans, set up a little experiment module and things like that. With the primary goal of just conferring some of the excitement of science and the sense of what we actually do and how we try to use simple models to inform. I will come back from this meeting or whatever and talk with my friends that I, you know, my running buddies or whatever, and you know, they'll be like, okay, are we taking hormones? Are we, you know, is this exercise really doing us any good, kinds of things? And so in an informal way, I try to get the lessons of the field in general to kind of best gauge what seems to be a good approach to health. But in terms of really doing anything in particular.
Well, sort of practical things. I mean, obviously, here's a piece from Cell Metabolism, Life is Short If Sweet, and it deals with glucose homeostasis, reducing its activity, delays the aging process, and so on. Plainly one of the things your mother told you, level of advice is to cut back on the amount of unrefined sugars and so on.
Right.
That's one thing. But then it gets more complicated, and, you know, should one be looking at these clinics where you can take growth hormone, for example,
right,
as you're aging?
I mean, right. Right. So these issues are very controversial, and as you've kind of touched on, there are concerns that people have different potential interests also in you know, marketing your growth hormone, administering it. And I attended one meeting where there was a tremendous amount of a debate about what was actually understood about growth hormone. And the bottom scientific line was that we really need to do a lot more research before we start administering these things to individuals.
Yeah, although, of course, people will say, as they're, you know, getting to an age and thinking that they need that stuff,
right,
what do you mean you want to do more scientific research? I don't have time. You
right.
know, let's.
Right.
Why haven't you delivered some solution right at this
right.
point? So there's this pressure on science to somehow deliver these practical solutions at the same time. What do you think about the relationship? This is slightly off a tangent, but I like to talk to everybody about this. What do you think about the relationship between science and social policy? There's a New England Journal of Medicine piece last year about whether, in fact, sugared products should be taxed. It's the cigarettes argument over again. What's the relationship between science and society
right.
in these sorts of areas and so
right.
on?
Right.
And indeed, that's an extension of the president's inaugural address, where he talked about restoring science to its rightful place.
Right.
What is its
right.
rightful place?
I think science and medical science has a really important responsibility to provide kind of our working model of, you know, at least at the level of advice and our best understanding for healthy living. So it is important for us to say, you know, look, why are there so many obese people in the United States? It's your eating. You've got it. You know, there has to be there should be incentives. There should be policies. I actually personally, what I'd like to see is the government to really have universal health care and everyone to be required to, you know, do X amount of exercise, because it's one of the clear things that that's important. So I think that we actually probably need to do a better job of recommendations for healthy living and figuring ways that we can make incentives for actually good health behavior. It could save the country, you know, billions
yes.
and billions and billions of dollars for a minor investment in well care and health and, you know, kind of healthy living. And, you know, it's a big ticket item in terms of, it's a complex issue, how you get individuals to behave in certain ways. But I think creative ideas about food incentives, are important. I think in the schools, I think it's really critically important that these ideas of responsible, you know, body citizenship and responsible health decisions really need to be kind of taught as and you know, good life habits. Like, for example, a lot of the, there's so much emphasis in schools on academics that the kid, little kids aren't getting gym classes. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it's just really the wrong life health message. And so I think there really needs to be an integration with kind of the end idea of, you know, living a long, healthy life that's kind of institutionalized in the way we you know, raise our kids.
Yeah. So do you have kids?
I have one son, 12 years old.
All right. Is he going to be a scientist or what?
I don't know. I'm afraid he got the architecture genes from my husband. But you know, all kids love science. It's fun. I think it's how they learn, how they figure out the world to begin with, is just through a scientific, you know, make a little hypothesis, this word means this, this word's... And eventually, I'm afraid that we kind of push that out of them, that curiosity and that constant testing by just giving them information. And so I think a lot of kids just, you know, enjoy poking around nature. And I think we need to encourage it a little more.
You know, there's two things. One, architecture is not bad. I mean, that's we actually do some programs on neuroscience and architecture. Uh-huh. Very interesting connections there. And of course, the Salk Institute
is a
wonderful
marvel,
Louis Kahn piece of architecture. In her book, The Canon, Natalie Angier has made this point that you're making as well in the conversation with the historian of science, Peter Gallison, that somehow we managed to knock this enthusiasm out of kids. So there obviously has to be a movement to make science more interesting, more palatable,
right,
more engaging.
Yes. I think that's less scary, I think, to grown-ups. I think, you know, getting good teachers who are not kind of intimidated by science, but who are, you know, in love with science. And I think we need less book and more hands-on kind of exploratory kinds of exercises as a, you know, core part of learning, that, you know, make the hypothesis and test it. It's fun. Mm. But it's, you know, often it's more, you know, this is how it works. And, you know, end of story. And much later in life, scientists begin to realize, like, you know, how do you know it works like that? But for most people, I think, you know, they just want to be told how it works, because we kind of beat out that inquisitive kind of show me why, let me figure out why kind of nature.
So are you interested in sort of history of science as well and so on?
You know, history of science is fascinating. I think I don't really get as much time to think about it, read about it, as I would like. And I can imagine having a sabbatical to just, you know.
Suppose you had a dinner party and you could have anybody there from history or whatever. I mean, who are the kind of people that you've always fascinated to do as you've been?
Well, you know, so I think I would probably think of people like, you know, kind of the classic scientists. I would love to talk with, you know, Mendel, Darwin, kind of the greatest hits of genetics, maybe, and scientific thought. I think it would be absolutely fascinating, especially, you know, this idea of the chance for the juxtaposition of time. So, you know, I always wonder what would Mendel actually think with, you know, confronted with modern day molecular genetics, like the incredible field that this, you know, this basic kind of thinking helped create, and was a major kind of cornerstone in our progression, and how you would feel to see this, you know, little thing you're doing just have evolved into so much greater understanding and enterprise.
Or if he'd been able to talk to Darwin at the same time.
Yes, yes. Right, the two of them. Right, like, can you imagine? It would be just, like, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. So, in terms of where this field is going, and this meeting as well, how do you assess it at this point?
Yeah, I'm excited. I think there's very good science. People are doing better work than ever and finding all kinds of new things. At the same time, it's almost staggering how complex the biology of aging is. And, the challenge of kind of retarding the progressive decline, just of kind of improving aging is really, also kind of dizzying. And so I take heart in the fact that we have identified certain drug interventions, and certain genetic interventions that do seem to make a big difference in the lab. And I think, actually, that there are going to be incredible advances in potential therapies. So, for example, stem cell biology is really exciting. And there are new capacities to kind of rejuvenate older cells. And I think these technologies are going to come along with, better genetic engineering kind of approaches in the next, I'm not sure the next 10 years, but I think we're going to see a revolution in our capacity to kind of interfere. And if we have in these smaller organisms or in basic research identified some key node points that we think that you push on that gives you a metabolism that's health promoting, then I think we're going to see a medical benefit.
You know what? I think here's the other thing that's very interesting to me is the way in which the Daniel Promislow's talk, for example, about the systems biology and so on. I know that this is not one of Sidney Brenner's favorite topics, but the interrelationship between these disciplines, the systems biology. One wonders whether that might have some promise in it as well.
I think so. I think that, as I was saying, if you start to think of all the different layers and complexities, and it's all really a four-dimensional thing. Things are changing in time, in concentration. There's a stochastic component to these age-associated changes. And so it's really kind of a mind-boggling combination of things. And we as scientists were kind of trained on these very simple linear models. I'm sure things don't work that way. And so we're going to need the systems and computational people to be able to collect these large sets of data that we're able to generate. And look for relationships that then we can take back and test in the lab. So I think it's a very exciting new forefront of science.
I was thinking as well that you have one of the people at Rutgers who's very good at dealing with complex systems and neurons and so on, Yuri Bujaki. So we'll probably visit him at some point as well. So perhaps we'll see you at Rutgers next time we're in. And find out what's been going on.
It would be a pleasure.
And see where you're at with your worms.
Okay, plan to advance.
All right, Monica Dishwood, thanks very much indeed.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.